welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. As you know, if you're a regular listener to our podcast, Revenue Rocket is the world premier growth strategy and M&A advisor to tech-enabled services companies. With me today is my partner, Ryan Barnett. Ryan, welcome.
Hey, good morning, Mike, and thanks so much for having us again today, and thanks to all of our listeners here who have been dedicated to listening to the podcast. We've got a growing number of people that have reached out to us, and thank you each and every one for you who have been tuning in. As always, please feel free to submit any kind of topics that you would like to info@revenuerocket.com. Just send us an email, and we'll be happy to dig into something that you'd like to talk about. We've got a couple deals, Mike, that are getting close to closing in the pipeline. I don't want to jinx ourselves, a little wood I'm knocking on, but one of the things when we get through a process, sellers ultimately, it's very important for them to understand, you know, what am I going to take home in that transaction? So if I got a deal that's on the table that starts out at $10 million, how much of that $10 million do I get to put in my pocket? And perhaps win. So today, Mike, I wanted to, you know, really pick your brain on what sellers should start to think about when they're framing up that number in their head, and how much of that goes into a kind of managing a deal or managing portions of the deal that really matter to the bottom line. So, Mike, there's lots of things to think about, from taxes through kind of deal structure or fees from your accounting or legal teams. Should we start with taxes?
Yeah, sure. Death and taxes, the only two absolutes that we have, I guess, in this world. But we'll talk a little bit about how deals get taxed. There's a couple levers to pull here to be thinking about taxes. If you are a IT services firm, which is certainly the lion's share of our listeners and where we focus in the marketplace, you probably have all of the purchase price allocation that would go into an M&A transaction, or the lion's share, I shouldn't say all, but the lion's share, will be allocated to goodwill. And I guess the best way to think about how a transaction is taxed in these various buckets, which we'll talk about here in a minute, you need to kind of roll with a guiding principle that kind of what's good for the buyer is bad for the seller, and vice versa from a tax perspective. If you look at most of the transactions in our space, are typically done as asset deals, although sometimes they're done as stock deals, or if you're in Canada, called a share purchase. The allocations aren't all that different. And if you're a seller, you may get advice from your counsel or from your accountant that, hey, you absolutely want a share purchase because that's the only way you're going to optimize your tax treatment on a deal. And as much as that is true in the absolute, it is not necessarily true completely in practice, because as a services firm, you don't have a lot of fixed assets. Generally, the allocations are, if not identical, pretty similar between an asset transaction and a stock transaction. And the best way to think about it is that you have to, in the eyes of the IRS or your tax authority, if you're in Canada, you have to allocate, send an allocation schedule of that purchase price to that tax authority within 30 days of close of a typical transaction. And you have to do that in partnership with your buyer if you are a seller. And if you are allocating purchase price to goodwill, which likely you will be doing so if you are a services firm, the lion's share of that, that will be considered a capital gains type tax as a seller. Anything that's allocated to just about anything else, either that be fixed assets or certainly cash and AR that may be purchased, that's going to be treated like ordinary income. And as you can imagine, the difference between those two tax rates, almost everywhere you live, is very material. So you want to try to allocate as much of the purchase price to goodwill as possible. Now, on the other hand, you know, you have the buyer, and any part of the purchase price that's allocated to goodwill by the buyer, that's considered a 15-year sort of amortization or depreciation schedule that they get to depreciate that purchase on their balance sheet over that period of time. If there's other allocations, like for fixed assets or for other things they might be acquiring, oftentimes that depreciation schedule is accelerated, or it's called a step-up depreciation. And they may be shorter periods of time, typically 7 years, but sometimes shorter, depending on the asset class. And depending on if it's been depreciated or not, and depending on fair market value. So you're probably getting the picture that, boy, some of this is kind of complicated. And the answer is it is. It's probably the business case for why you need to have a competent M&A advisor working with you. But also, more importantly, you need to have a competent tax advisor. Any M&A transaction typically has some tax ramifications. This is also the case if you're in Canada. If our listeners are in Canada, as you know, you guys have some fairly favorable tax treatment options up there when you sell a business. Particularly if you have formulated a family trust, and there's some laws and rules that go into that. And as a result, you need to have a competent tax advisor help you so you can structure a deal in such a way to be tax efficient. So hopefully that helps, Ryan.
Yeah, I think that's a great start. Just off the top of your head, Mike, is to just to refresh where people are at. So if it's a largely attributed to goodwill, you're going to have a capital gains type allocation. And capital gains, how, you know, from a percentage wise, what does that look like for a company?
Well, you'll have the federal capital gains tax. And oftentimes, depending on what state you're in, you have a state capital gains tax. So I think the thing to keep in mind is that it depends, and I don't want to be vague about this. You know, in some case, most of the time, it'd be a 20% capital gains on a long-term capital gains tax rate. However, there are certain situations when it may be different, and your state capital gains rate can be, you know, anywhere from 2.5% to, in some cases, 11.5%. I think in Florida, depending on how the capital gains is treated there, it can all go all the way up to ordinary income. So there are some safe harbor states where capital gains can be applied appropriately, but you have to make sure that you structure the transaction properly. And I guess where I would, comment I would make on that is to make sure that as you're contemplating a transaction, you're talking to your tax advisor about how to best not only structure the deal to optimize it for tax for you, but also getting input on your specific situation with your M&A advisor.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And just one more shout out to the, just to make sure we are not tax advisors here at Revenue Rocket. And it's something that we have to be smart enough to do it, but we're not tax. We're going to defer those questions over to your tax advisor. But what I'm hearing, you know, at the very least, a seller in the general side could be as low as 15%. It could be as high as 40% or somewhere in those levels, depending on how you treat those. So it is a significant portion to consider and something that you should have in your planning when going into any transaction.
And you should also know, depending on how your business has been incorporated, whether it's an LLC or an S or a C Corp, and depending on the buyer's classification, there's ways to structure share transactions or stock deals and have them also qualify for step-up basis amortization by the buyer. And so, again, this just, you know, probably muddies the water further, but, you know, there's called what's called a Section 338H10 election and a variety of other sort of obtuse areas of the IRS code if you're in the States that will allow for sort of special tax treatment. In Canada, certainly there's some capital gains exemptions that you're eligible to participate in as a small business. And it just, you know, again, portends that you should be going to a CA if you're north of the border in Canada and your CPA who gives you tax advice here in the States to get further clarification on those items.
Great. That makes sense. That makes sense. We've talked about this in previous podcasts, but one of the benefits of when you sell your company, it's one of the few times you get to harvest cash out of the business. So, and oftentimes, if you think about a deal, you may have an enterprise value. It doesn't necessarily, it's typically what we, you may see this as a cash-free or debt-free type transaction. And Mike, we can go into this as deep as you want, but on a high level, you're going to have to extinguish any kind of debt that comes with it. But your buyer is also going to not necessarily bring cash with the exception of some working capital. So I'd love for you to unpack, again, if we're thinking about a transaction and where you should be planning on how much you get to take home. Yes, you get to harvest cash, but not all of it. So, Mike, walk me through kind of that working capital equation.
Right. So it's pretty typical to require that there's a certain level of working capital required to manage the business. And on the simplest terms, you know, it's current assets equaling current liabilities with about a 30-day sort of AR cushion on top of that. If you manage your AR to relatively current thresholds, DSOs of about 30 days or typically around 30 days. And what the buyer is trying to do is make sure that they don't have to inject capital into the business in order to run it. There's this concept called selling your business as a going concern. A going concern implies that there is enough working capital to run the business moving forward. And so, you know, that is what helps establish what's called the working capital peg. And the working capital peg, any amount in addition to the working capital peg, is something where you can harvest. And when you harvest it, there's a variety of mechanisms for that. Sometimes you can harvest it based on, you know, a close, depending on the size and sophistication of the buyer. Sometimes you will harvest it at a true update in the future. That could be at 90 days or, you know, in some cases as long as 6 months, where you also net out expenses that may be incurred in the business that the buyer or you as a seller didn't know about, but occurred under your watch or before you sold the business. And then that excess working capital can be used sort of as a slush account to cover the expenses that you would be responsible for. And then you net it out in a payment at the end of the true up period. But, you know, what Ryan says is right. The only time you really get to harvest excess working capital out of the business is when you sell it you know, a new buyer takes on the business. Now, there's some amount of art and finance expertise that's required to get these calculations right. And there's also some planning that you might want to be thinking about up to potentially a year ahead of time in order to minimize the negotiation around how much is enough working capital. And so I would encourage you to definitely employ an advisor like Revenue Rocket to front those working capital conversations with potential buyers so that you're able to optimize your working capital harvest. Certainly your accountant can help, but I think advisors tend to have a lot more experience and practice in doing this. And it's certainly something we do every month on behalf of our clients. And I would encourage you guys to be getting opinions about that well in advance of contemplating a transaction.
No, great, great point. And just don't let it be a surprise that it's a pretty logical thing. You need to have cash in the business in order to operate it in that transition time and make sure that there's adequate cash there. And that should be a consideration if you receive an LOI or receive a purchase agreement. Also keep in mind that debt. So if you have a lot of debt, that's going to be something that doesn't come over. Now, keep in mind you also get to a lot of that is attributed back to deal structure. You know, you can consider things like interest expense and amortization and depreciation. Those all are considered part of, you know, EBITDA. So that debt is, you know, configured in some levels there. But at the end of the day, if you have a debt load that you're paying, the buyer is going to expect that to be debt-free and understand that you may have to pay down some bills to get there.
Yeah, and just to add to that, Ryan, you know, when we talk about debt, we talk about really long-term debt is what we're talking about here. Short-term debt or near-term debt is oftentimes trade payables, right? And trade payables usually do come along in a transaction. And what I mean by trade payables is it could be your internet bill or your telephone bill, or, you know, maybe it's some sort of utility bill or lease or whatever, lease on your office space. Those are considered trade payables, and those are acceptable, and are covered off on your balance sheet. When you calculate working capital, they show up on the liability side of your balance sheet. But long-term debt, will need to be extinguished as either from the proceeds of the transaction or ahead of time. And part of that's because, I can attribute it to, you know, say you're going to buy a car, you wouldn't want to buy a car that someone else still has a loan on, right? You can't transfer the title, with those encumbrances on the car. Same thing would apply in your business. Typically those that would have long-term debt, would have a filing, to secure that loan, on at least your receivables. You need to be able to sell the business without any encumbrances, and we'll need to have all of those liens released. And to release them, you need to be able to pay off that debt either simultaneous to the release or, in some level, you get the release within a short period of time once paying that debt.
Yeah, great summary. If I change gears here a little bit, some of the thing, you're thinking about the take home portion of a deal, oftentimes deals will have what we call structure to that. And what we mean by that, there might be a deferred payment through something like a seller note. We've got podcasts on seller notes. It might be an earnout, and we've got podcasts on earnouts, and we've got podcasts on deal structure that deals with equity. Now, oftentimes there's the deferred portion to that. So it's something to think about. You may earn that money. And in case of something like equity, it may be certainly more valuable in the future than it is today. But Mike, what consideration should people think when they think about deal structure and perhaps some of those deferred type payments?
Well, there's two things to think about. You know, first is the enterprise value or the price. For the business. And that's a number. And in this case, we've been using an example today of like $10 million. And then there's terms, right? The terms might be, well, how are you going to get to that $10 million or more in some cases? In the simplest terms, someone would just pay you cash at close, and you would get that. And you would get, your working capital harvest within, let's say at the end of your true-up period. And that would be it. But much more commonly, a deal does include some structure, either in the case of a seller note, which you'll still get the money, or secured creditor of the buyer in that case, generally. And you will, be in a position to have that buyer pay you a payment, just like a loan from a bank. You would be the bank in this case, with some sort of interest. And as a result, you're getting sort of paid out over time. Likewise, you might want to take what's called a gain share agreement or an earnout, where you're going to stay on and you're going to be involved and you're going to participate in the distribution of meeting particular milestones in the business. And usually this has to do with achieving your growth forecast or being able to play an active role in sales or maybe in a variety of different roles. And you're participating in in some cases, the revenue or profitability that's produced by the business over a period of time. You do well, you'll get more during that period of time. You do poorly, the business does poorly, you'll get less. And so when you think about earnouts or gain share agreements, it's really important, again, to have a partner that's structured these properly so that they get paid out and you're fairly compensated for the performance that come later. When you think about equity is taking some of the existing equity in the business, and let's say you're a business owner that owns all of it at this point, you own 100% of your equity. It's not uncommon for capital partners in particular, private equity type firms, to acquire up to 70%, in some cases 80% of your equity and pay you out. either through cash and or structure that we've just discussed. And then what's called roll equity, and that roll of equity is you're essentially swapping your ownership or equity portion for that of the bigger entity. And then you have the ability to have that equity appreciate over time. And then at some point, there'll be a triggering event. A triggering event may include the sale of the business again. It might include another recapitalization by a bigger investor. It may include a variety of things, including you having a convertible option on your equity that allows you to turn it into a note over a period of time. Or it just may include that you can call the sale of your shares back to the corporation at a particular determined time and get your money out that way. So, you know, there's all these different terms is the best way to think about it that could be applied to your deal. And you have to understand those, and you have to understand those as it relates to not only the timing of when you'll get your money, but also kind of what the tax implications are for that, because you certainly can use structure to your advantage to help with tax planning as well.
Yeah, that was exactly my question. So there's still going to be some application of taxes, but if you use some of these, you may defer some of them to later times. You may defer amounts, and it may be taxed at different tax rates or and such. So just keep in mind, if you keep thinking take home pay, I think there's a couple things to consider. One is if you think about something like a secured note, that's what we'd kind of put in the same category as a cash, almost cash. It may not be a close, but it's going to be almost better than cash, that you'll get an interest rate on that. So you'll get your take home is a little bit more than the purchase price, because it'll actually have some interest on that. And so think of those guaranteed payments are going to be something that comes back to, and you'll be able to rely on. And then equity, it should have good performance, but it perhaps has some risk associated with it. So you can balance that out. I have heard sellers say that an earnout is worth nothing, or that a seller note may not be paid out. And we think that's just flat out false, and something that if you structure a deal correctly and earn out with the right structure and attainable metrics for you, and this is where a competent M&A advisor will align a deal that works for the seller and for the buyer, that those deals are actually paid out more often than not. So just because your deal may have an earnout, that could be a great opportunity to earn more than the enterprise value if it's structured in the right way. Then the last category I just want to talk about here, Mike, is again, we're looking at take home type fees, or take home, take home what's going to be in your pocket after a deal. If you have some great advisors along the way, you're going to expect to pay some fees for them. So, Mike, the big three, I think, are kind of an M&A advisory fee, which is oftentimes really tied to a success fee. You may have some monthly retainers, but keep in mind those can be added back to profit in your EBIT, in most deals done, because they're done on a multiple EBITDA, will be considered a favorable add back. So you get kind of more and above on what you put in a deal. So you've got some fees there, and that could be from 2 to 5%, maybe more or less, but something just to think about for a success fee. And you also have, I think, legal fees and accounting fees. So any kind of preparation you need for accounting, keep in mind that might detract from the overall price, or you may need to allocate some of what you're working on into those type of fees. Same with legal fees, and that's oftentimes more a per hour basis, but it's critical to get the right representation who will help really mitigate risks throughout the whole process to you. Mike, those are M&A fees, accounting firm, or M&A advisory, accounting and legal fees. Are there any other professional services fees that a seller should earmark?
Yeah, I mean, there may be some financial planning advisory that you need to do beyond tax. We think it's important to get good tax advice on how your deal will be handled and how to plan for that. But it's also important to understand how you're going to invest this money. Typically, you know, most sellers, this is their single largest asset. And when they sell, you know, in many cases, it's been in some cases a proxy for much of retirement planning, because a lot of entrepreneurs put everything they got into a business and to grow it to be a point where, you know, their future is sort of tied up in equity value in that business. And so understanding how to plan those investments so you can optimize them for return, I think, is super important. A couple of comments I would also make on legal and accounting fees. You want to make sure you have aligned interest with your legal advisor and your accounting advisor to get a transaction done. And I'd say this is particularly important with your legal advisor. And what I mean by that is it may be better to negotiate a fixed fee arrangement with your lawyer versus hourly if they'll accept that, because then you're both incented to be efficient and get a deal done versus less so. You know, we often say that there's two kinds of lawyers, sort of deal makers and deal breakers. And deal makers, whether they're paid hourly or on a fixed fee, are focused on helping you get the deal done and find a reasonable sort of middle of the road position on many of the things that will be discussed around the legal negotiations. And, you know, deal breakers are much more focused on kind of a win-lose negotiating arrangement for which they can optimize billing and fees. And we see huge fee changes in legal billings with the latter. You know, they can inflate fees by 2 to 3 times if that's their approach to the negotiation. And we certainly don't find that to be very palatable, and nor would I think you would as a customer. So it's important to pick an experienced M&A lawyer that has a good reputation, that is experienced in deals your size. And you know, you may have be able to talk to some of your peers in the market that can refer someone that they've either used in the past or is a credible source. Or you can check in with firms like us that have worked with many, many law firms across the U.S. and Canada in particular. And we're happy at any time to make a referral if you need to work with someone who's experienced in the space, but also is a deal maker.
No, great point, Mike. And when we walk through this, it somewhat feels there's a lot here. So I think I don't want sellers to feel overwhelmed here, but I do want you to feel educated going into what you should expect. These are all, I would say, our normal course of business. And it, much like Mike had said, there's few things in life that are more certain than death and taxes. It's something we have to, as long as we can prepare for and move ahead, it's going to be inevitable. So keep a long-term planning in mind when you're executing it. Things like fees, and it can feel like a bit of a death by a thousand cuts. And there's, you know, at the end, there's going to be a reward, and that's going to be likely a big amount of money. And it should be something that is celebrated and something that can help your future state. So don't let some fees in the meantime kind of get to you from ultimately closing a deal. It can be a something where it's something more easily than you would think to get fed up upon. You have to look at there's longer term success for me in the terms of payment, and there's a lot of risk to continue to run your own business. You know, every day that you don't sell it, that's more risk, and that's the potential that you get nothing for it if the business doesn't perform how you think you're going to. So keep all those things in mind. The greater goal of working towards a deal, these are things that you should plan for, but it shouldn't stop you from executing a deal. Mike, I think I can get to a point where, you know, let me read back to you what I listen back. If you think about this, there's going to be your take home from the original price. Think about the impacts, and some of those are going to be taxes. And some of those things like stock and asset purchases will make a big difference. So for example, if you allocated the purchase price towards goodwill, that's going to be a capital gains treatment versus maybe towards assets, which may hit ordinary income. So make sure you're working with that tax advisor to allocate your purchase price adequately. You'll really need to account for an adequate level of working capital. So there's going to be some cash left in the business. Work with your M&A advisor and accounting firm to kind of minimize your level there, but also just be understanding that a buyer is going to require some level of working capital. Hopefully it's not an overreach. You also need to clear out long-term debt. So you'll be able to use things like the proceeds of the sale, but at the end of the mind, keep in mind those will have to be paid. And you also likely have to consider some kind of deal structure. So that might be deferred payments. That might be earn out, might be equity. And oftentimes that gives you an opportunity to earn more than that initial enterprise value, but it comes with the cost of a time and some potential risk. Again, that aligning that risk with that buyer can make that opportunity even greater. And then the last thing to consider, you're going to have some fees in the process. So between perhaps an M&A advisor, an accounting firm, or legal fees, just be prepared to set some money to make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. Mike, anything else you want to add to that?
No, I just add just one comment about thinking about advisory fees. Typically, when an M&A advisor is involved, they will more than pay for their fees. And so, you know, I would certainly charter them to do so in finding efficiencies in the deal and being able to represent you competently in the negotiation. And I think, you know, most of our clients, as well as others that use advisors, will say that. I think when you think about legal fees, you know, understanding, trying to get some guidance on capping fees or getting some guidance around a fixed fee arrangement is the way you can be more efficient there. And they're much more, the lawyer is much more about mitigating risk, right? Mitigating your risk along the way. And then on the accounting side, it's really about mitigating tax. And so you think about these three buckets, you know, M&A advisors help you get the deal done, lawyers help you mitigate risk, and accountants help you minimize tax. And those are all laudable and appropriate things for you to encourage you have the best team on your side to get it done. So with that, I think we'll tie a ribbon on it for this week's Shoot the Moon podcast. I encourage you to tune in next week when we'll unpack additional ideas about growth strategy and M&A for IT services firms worldwide. Thanks a lot for tuning in and make it a great week.